She made a contemptuous gesture, pushing the thought of Jamie aside, and reached into the pocket at her waist, bringing out a folded letter. "I've come to ask ye a favour," she said. And for the first time, I heard the tremor in her voice. "Read that, if you will," she added, and pressed her lips tight together. I looked warily at her pocket, but it was flat. If she'd brought a pistol, she wasn't carrying it there. I picked up the letter and motioned her to the chair on the other side of the desk. If she took it into her head to attack me, I'd have a little warning. Still, I wasn't really afraid of her. She was upset, that was clear, but very much in control of herself. I opened the letter, and with the occasional glance to be sure she stayed where she was, began to read. 15th of February, 1778, Philadelphia. Philadelphia, I said, startled, and looked up at Lyra. She nodded. They went there in the summer last year, himself thinking it would be safer. Her lips twisted a little. 2 months later, the British army came a-marching into the city, and there they've been since. Himself, I supposed, was Fergus. I noted the usage with interest. Evidently, Lyra had become reconciled to her older daughter's husband, for she used the word without irony. Dear ma'am, I must ask you to do something for love of me and my children. The trouble is with Henri Christian. Because of his oddness of form, he has always had some trouble in breathing, particularly when suffering from the catarrh, and has snored like a grampus since he was born. Now he has taken to stopping breathing altogether when he sleeps, save he is propped up with cushions in a particular position. Mother Claire had looked in his throat when she and Da saw us in New Bern, and said then that his adenoids, this being something in his throat, were over-large and might give trouble in future. Jermaine has these also and breathes with his mouth open a good deal of the time, but it is not a danger to him as it is to Henri Christian. I am in mortal terror that Henri Christian will stop breathing one night, and no one will know in time to save him. We take it in turns to sit up with him, to keep his head just right, and to wake him when he stops breathing. But I do not know how long we can contrive to keep it up. Fergus is worn out with the work of the shop, and I with the work of the house. I help in the shop as well, and so, of course, does Jermaine. The little girls are great help to me in the house, bless them, and so willing to care for their little brother. But they cannot be left to sit up with him by night alone. I have had a physician to look at Henri Christian. He agrees that the adenoids are likely to blame for the obstruction of breathing, and he bled the wee lad, and gave me medicine to shrink them. But this was of no use at all, and only made Henri Christian cry and vomit. Mother Claire, forgive me for speaking of her to you, for I know your feelings, but I must, had said that it might be necessary to remove Henri Christian's tonsils and adenoids at some point, to ease his breathing. And plainly, this point has been reached. She did this for the Beardsley twins some time ago on the ridge, and I would trust no one else to attempt such an operation on Henri Christian. Will you go to see her, ma'am? I think she must be at Lallybroch now, and I will write to her there, begging her to come to Philadelphia as soon as possible. But I fear my inability to communicate the horror of our situation. As you love me, ma'am, please go to her and ask her to come as quickly as may be. Your most affectionate daughter, Marsali. I set down the letter. I fear my inability to communicate the horror of our situation. No, she'd done that all right. Sleep apnea, they called it, the tendency to stop breathing suddenly when asleep. It was common, and much more common in some sorts of dwarfism, where the respiratory airways were constricted by the skeletal abnormalities. Most people who had it would wake themselves, thrashing and snorting as they breathed again, but the enlarged adenoids and tonsils obstructing his throat, probably a hereditary problem, I thought distractedly, for I'd noted them in Germaine, and to a lesser extent in the girls, as well, would aggravate the difficulty, since even if the reflex that causes a person short of oxygen to breathe kicked in belatedly, Henri Christian likely couldn't draw the immediate deep breath that would waken him. The vision of Massali and Fergus, and probably Germain, taking it in turns to sit up in a dark house, watching the little boy sleep, perhaps nodding off themselves in the cold and quiet, jerking awake in terror lest he have shifted in his sleep and stopped breathing. A sick knot of fear had formed under my ribs, reading the letter. Lyra was watching me, blue eyes direct under her cap. For once, the anger, hysteria, and suspicion with which she had always regarded me was gone. "If you go," she said, and swallowed. "I'll give up the money." I stared at her. "If you think that I began incredulously, but stopped. Well, yes, she plainly did believe I would require to be bribed. She thought that I had abandoned Jamie after Culloden, returning only when he had become prosperous again. I struggled with the urge to try to tell her, but that was pointless, and quite beside the point now, too. The situation was clear and sharp as broken glass. She leaned forward abruptly, her hands on the desk, pressed down so hard that her fingernails were white. "Please," she said. "Please." I was conscious of strong, conflicting urges, on the one hand to smack her, and on the other to put a sympathetic hand over hers. I fought down both and forced myself to think calmly for a moment. I would go, of course. I'd have to. It had nothing to do with Lyra or with what lay between us. If I didn't go, and Henri Christian died, he well might, I'd never be able to live with myself. If I came in time, I could save him. No one else could. It was as simple as that. My heart sank precipitously at the thought of leaving Lallybroch now. How horrible! How could I, knowing that I left Ian for the last time, perhaps leaving them all and the place itself for the last time? But even as I thought these things, the part of my mind that was a surgeon had already grasped the necessity and was setting about the business of planning the quickest way to Philadelphia, contemplating how I should acquire what I needed once there, the possible obstructions and complications that might arise, all the practical analysis of how I should do what had so subtly been asked of me. And as my mind clicked through these things, the ruthless logic, overwhelming shock, subduing emotion, it began to dawn upon me that this sudden disaster might have other aspects. Lyra was waiting, eyes fixed on me, her mouth firm, willing me to do it. "All right," I said, leaning back in my chair and fixing her in turn with a level look. "Let's come to terms then, shall we?" "So," I said, eyes fixed on the light of a grey heron as it crossed the loch, "we made a bargain. I'll go to Philadelphia as quickly as I can to take care of Henri Christian. She'll marry Joey, give up the alimony, and give her permission for Joan to go to the convent. Though I suppose we'd best get it in writing, just in case." Jamie stared at me, speechless. We were sitting in the long, rough grass at the side of the loch, where I'd brought him to tell him what had happened, and what was going to happen. "She, Lyra, has kept Joan's dowry intact. Joan will have that for travelling and for her entry to the convent," I added. I took a deep breath, hoping to keep my voice steady. "I'm thinking that, well, Michael will be leaving in a few days. Joan and I could go with him to France. I could sail from there on a French ship, and he could see her safely to her convent." "You," he began, and I reached to squeeze his hand to stop him speaking. "You can't go now, Jamie," I said softly. "I know you can't." He closed his eyes, grimacing, and his hand tightened on mine in instinctive denial of the obvious. I clung to his fingers just as tightly, in spite of the fact that it was his tender right hand I held. The thought of being parted from him for any amount of time or space, let alone the Atlantic Ocean and the months it might take before we saw each other again, made the bottom of my stomach fall away and filled me with desolation and a sense of vague terror. He would go with me if I asked, if I even gave him room for doubt about what he must do. I must not. He needed this so much, needed what small time remained with Ian, needed even more to be here for Jenny when Ian died. For he could be her comfort in a way that not even her children could be. And if he had needed to go and see Lyra out of guilt over the failure of their marriage, how much more acute would be his guilt at abandoning his sister yet again, and in her most desperate time of need? "You can't leave," I whispered, urgent. "I know, Jamie." He opened his eyes again and looked at me, eyes dark with anguish. "I canna let you go. Not without me." "It won't be long," I said, forcing the words past the lump in my throat, a lump that acknowledged both my sorrow in parting from him and the greater sorrow for the reason why our separation wouldn't be a long one. "I've gone farther by myself, after all," I said, trying to smile. His mouth moved, wanting to respond, but the trouble in his eyes didn't change. I lifted his crippled hand to my lips and kissed it, pressed my cheek against it. My head turned away, but a tear ran down my cheek, and I knew he felt the wetness of it on his hand, for his other hand reached for me and drew me into him, and we sat pressed together for a long, long time, listening to the wind that stirred the grass and touched the water. The heron had set down at the far side of the loch and stood on one leg, patiently waiting amid the tiny ripples. "We'll need a lawyer," I said at last, not moving. "Is Ned Gowan still alive?" Much to my astonishment, Ned Gowan was still alive. How old could he possibly be, I wondered, looking at him. 85? 90? He was toothless and wrinkled as a crumpled paper bag, but still jaunty as a cricket, and with his lawyer's bloodlust quite intact. He had drawn up the agreement of annulment for the marriage between Jamie and Lyra, cheerfully arranging the annual payments to Lyra, the dowries for Marsali and Joan. He set himself now, just as cheerfully, to dismantling it. "No, the question of Mistress Joan's dowry," he said, thoughtfully licking the point of his quill. "You specified, sir, in the original document that this amount, may I say this very generous amount, was to be endowed upon the young woman upon the occasion of her marriage, and to remain her sole property thereafter, not passing to her husband." "Aye, that's right," Jamie said, not very patiently. He told me privately that he would prefer to be staked out naked on an anthill than to deal with a lawyer for more than 5 minutes, and we'd been dealing with the complications of this agreement for a good hour.
So, she is not marrying, Mr. Gowan explained,
with the indulgence due to someone not very bright but still worthy of respect by reason of the fact that he was paying the lawyer's fee.
The question of whether she can receive the dowry under this contract.
She is marrying, Jamie said. She's becoming a bride of Christ, you ignorant Protestant.
I glanced at Ned in some surprise, having never heard that he was a Protestant, but he made no demur at this. Mr. Gowan, sharp as ever, noticed my surprise and smiled at me, eyes twinkling.
I have no religion save the law, ma'am, he said. Observance of one form of ritual over another is irrelevant. God, to me, is the personification of justice, and I serve him in that guise.
Jamie made a Scottish noise deep in his throat in response to this sentiment.
Aye, and a fat lot of good that will do you and your clients here ever realise you're no a papist.
Mr. Gowan's small dark eyes didn't cease to twinkle as he turned them on Jamie.
I am sure you dinna suggest such a low thing as blackmail, sir. Why, I hesitate even to name that honourable Scottish institution, knowing as I do the nobility of your character. and the fact that you're no going to get this bloody contract done without me.
Jamie sighed deeply and settled into his chair.
I get on with it. What's to do about the dowry, then?
Ah. Mr. Gowan turned with alacrity to the matter at hand.
I have spoken with the young woman regarding her own wishes in the matter. As the original maker of the contract, you may, with the consent of the other signatory, which I understand has been given.
He uttered a dry little cough at this oblique mention of Lyra.
Alter the terms of the original document. Since, as I say, Mistress Joan does not propose to wed, do you wish to rescind the dowry altogether, to keep the existing terms, or to alter them in some way?
I want to give the money to June, Jamie said, with an air of relief at finally being asked something concrete.
Absolutely? Mr. Gowan inquired, pen poised. The word absolutely having a meaning in the law other than,
you said you talked to June. What the devil does she want, then?
Mr. Gowan looked happy, as he usually did upon perceiving a new complication.
She wishes to accept only a small portion of the original dowry, this to be used to provide for her reception into a convent. Such a donation is customary, I believe.
Aye?
Jamie raised one eyebrow.
And what about the rest?
She wishes the residue to be given to her mother, Lyra Mackenzie Fraser, but not given absolutely, if you follow me. Given with conditions.
Jamie and I exchanged looks.
What conditions? He asked carefully.
Mr. Gowan held up a withered hand, folding down the fingers as he enumerated the conditions.
1. That the money shall not be released until a proper record of the marriage of Lyra Mackenzie Fraser and Joseph Boswell Murray shall be written in the parish register of Brochmorda, witnessed and attested by a priest. 2. That a contract be signed, reserving and guaranteeing the estate of Balriggan and all its inclusive goods as the sole property of Lyra Mackenzie Fraser until her death, thereafter being willed as the aforesaid Lyra Mackenzie Fraser shall so dispose in a proper will. 3. The money shall not be given absolutely, but shall be retained by a trustee and dispersed in the amount of £20 per annum, paid jointly to the aforesaid Lyra Mackenzie Fraser and Joseph Boswell Murray. 4. That these annual payments shall be used only for matters pertaining to the upkeep and improvement of the estate of Balriggan. 5. That payment of each year's disbursement shall be contingent upon the receipt of proper documentation regarding the use of the previous year's disbursement.
He folded down his thumb and lowered his closed fist and held up one finger of his other hand.
6. And lastly, that one James Alexander Gordon Fraser Murray of Lallybroch shall be trustee for these funds. Are these conditions agreeable, sir?
They are, Jamie said firmly, rising to his feet. Make it so, if you please, Mr. Gowan. And now, if no one minds, I'm going away and having a wee dram. Possibly 2.
Mr. Gowan capped his inkwell, tidied his notes into a neat pile, and likewise rose, though more slowly.
I'll join you in that dram, Jamie. I want to hear about this war of yours in America. It sounds the grandest of adventures.
Chapter 83 Counting Sheep. As the time grew shorter, Ian found it impossible to sleep. The need to go, to find Rachel, burned in him so that he felt hot coals in the pit of his stomach all of the time. Auntie Claire called it heartburn, and it was. She said it was from bolting his food, though, and it wasn't that. He could barely eat. He spent his days with his father as much as he could, sitting in the corner of the speaker word room, watching his father and his elder brother go about the business of Lallybroch. He couldn't understand how it would be possible to stand up and walk away, to leave them behind, to leave his father forever behind. During the days, there were things to be done, folk to be visited, to talk to. and the land to be walked over, the stark beauty of it soothing when his feelings grew too heated to bear. At night, though, the house lay quiet, the creaking silence punctuated by his father's distant cough and his two young nephews' heavy breathing in the room beside him. He began to feel the house itself breathe around him, drawing one ragged, heavy-chested gasp after another, and to feel the weight of it on his own chest. So he sat up in bed, gulping air, only to be sure he could. And finally, he would slide out of bed, steal downstairs with his boots in his hands, and let himself out of the kitchen door to walk the night under clouds or stars, the clean wind fanning the coals of his heart to open flame, until he should find his tears and peace in which to shed them. One night he found the door unbolted already. He went out cautiously, looking round, but saw no one. Likely young Jamie gone to the barn. One of the two cows was due to calf any day. He should go and help, maybe. But the burning under his ribs was painful. He needed to walk a bit first. Jamie would have fetched him in any case had he thought he needed help. He turned away from the house and its outbuildings and headed up the hill, past the sheep pen, where the sheep lay in somnolent mounds, pale under the moon, now and then emitting a soft sudden baa, as though startled by some sheep dream. Such a dream took shape before him suddenly, a dark form moving against the fence, and he uttered a brief cry that made the nearer sheep start and rustle in a chorus of low-pitched baas.
"Hush, Avalich," his mother said softly. "Get this lot started, and you'll wake the dead."
He could make her out now, a small, slender form with her unbound hair a soft mass against the paleness of her shift.
"Speak of the dead," he said rather crossly, forcing his heart down out of his throat. "I thought you were a ghost. What are you doing out here, ma'am?" "Counting sheep," she said, a thread of humour in her voice. "That's what you're meant to do when you can't sleep, aye?"
"Aye."
He came and stood beside her, leaning on the fence.
"Does it work?"
"Sometimes." They stood for a bit, watching the sheep stir and settle. They smelled sweetly filthy of chewed grass and sheep shit and greasy wool, and Ian found that it was oddly comforting just to be with them.
"Does it work to count them when you ken already how many there are?" he asked after a short silence.
His mother shook her head.
"No. I say their names over. It's like saying the rosary, only you dinna feel the need to be asking. It wears you down, asking."
"Especially when you ken the answer's going to be no,"
Ian thought, and moved by sudden impulse, put his arm around her shoulders. She made a small sound of amused surprise, but then relaxed, laying her head against him. He could feel the small bones of her, light as a bird's, and thought his heart might break. They stood for a while that way, and then she freed herself, gently moving away a little and turning to him.
"Sleepy yet?"
"No."
"I will. Come on, then."
Not waiting for an answer, she turned and made her way through the dark, away from the house. There was a moon, half full, and he'd been out more than long enough for his eyes to adjust. It was simple to follow, even through the jumbled grass and stones and heather that grew on the hill behind the house. Where was she taking him? Or rather, why? For they were heading uphill toward the old broch, and the burying ground that lay nearby. He felt a chill round his heart. Did she mean to show him the site of his father's grave? But she stopped abruptly and stooped, so he nearly tripped over her. Straightening up, she turned and put a pebble into his hand.
"Over here," she said softly,
and led him to a small square stone set in the earth. He thought it was Caitlin's grave, the child who'd come before young Jenny, the sister who'd lived but one day, but then saw that Caitlin's stone lay a few feet away. This one was the same size and shape, but he squatted by it, and running his fingers over the shadows of its carving, made out the name. Yes, sir.
Ma'am?
He said, and his voice sounded strange to his own ears. Is that right, Ian? She said, a little anxious. Your da said he wasn't quite certain of the spelling of the Indian name. I had the stone carver put both, though. I thought that was right.
Booth?
But his hand had already moved down and found the other name. Ishabel. He swallowed hard.
That was right, he said very softly.
His hand rested flat on the stone, cool under his palm. She squatted down beside him and, reaching, put her own pebble on the stone.
It was what you did, he thought, stunned, when you came to visit the dead. You left a pebble to say you'd been there, that you hadn't forgotten.
His own pebble was still in his other hand. He couldn't quite bring himself to lay it down. Tears were running down his face, and his mother's hand was on his arm.
It's all right, Madunna, she said softly. Go to your young woman. You'll always be here with us.
The steam of his tears rose like the smoke of incense from his heart, and he laid the pebble gently on his daughter's grave, safe among his family. It wasn't until many days later, in the middle of the ocean, that he realized his mother had called him a man. Chapter 84. The Right of It. Ian died just after dawn. The night had been hellish. A dozen times Ian had come close to drowning in his own blood, choking, eyes bulging, then rising up in convulsions, spewing up bits of his lungs. The bed looked like some slaughter had taken place, and the room reeked of the sweat of a desperate, futile struggle, the smell of death's presence. In the end, though, he had lain quiet, thin chest barely moving, the sound of his breathing a faint rattle like the scratch of the rose briars at the window. Jamie had stood back to give young Jamie the place at Ian's side as eldest son. Jenny had sat all night on his other side, wiping away the blood, the evil sweat, all the foul liquids that oozed from Ian, dissolving his body before their eyes. But near the end, in the dark, Ian had raised his right hand and whispered, "Jamie." He hadn't opened his eyes to look, but all of them knew which Jamie it was that he wanted. And young Jamie had made way, stumbling, so that his uncle could come and grasp that seeking hand. Ian's bony fingers had closed round his with surprising strength. Ian had murmured something, too low to hear, and then let go. Not in the involuntary relaxation of death. Simply, let go. That business done, and let his hand fall back open to his children. He didn't speak again, but seemed to settle, his body diminishing as life and breath fled from it. When his last breath came, they waited in dull misery, expecting another, and only after a full minute of silence did they begin to look at one another covertly, steal glances at the ravaged bed, the stillness in Ian's face, and realized slowly that it was over at last. Did Jenny mind, he wondered, that Ian's last words had been to him? But he thought not. The one mercy to a going such as his brother-in-law's had been was that there was time to take leave. He had made time to speak alone with each of his children, Jamie knew, comfort them as he could, maybe leave them with a bit of advice, at the least the reassurance that he loved them. He'd been standing next to Jenny when Ian died. She had sighed and seemed to slump beside him, as though the iron rod that had run up her back for the last year had suddenly been pulled out through her head. Her face had showed no sorrow, though he knew it was there. For that moment, though, she'd only been glad it was over, for Ian's sake. For all their sakes. So surely they had found time, she and Ian, to say what had to be said between them in the months since they knew. What would he say to Claire in such circumstances, he wondered suddenly. probably what he had said to her, parting a few weeks before.
I love you. I'll see you again.
He didn't see any way of improving on the sentiment, after all. He couldn't stay in the house. The women had washed Ian and laid him out in the parlour, and were now embarked on an orgy of furious cooking and cleaning, for word had gone out, and people were already beginning to come for the wake. The day had dawned spitting rain, but for the moment none was falling. He went out through the kale yard and climbed the little slope to the arbour. Jenny was sitting there, and he hesitated for a moment, but then came and sat down beside her.
She could send him away if she wanted solitude.
She didn't. She reached up for his hand, and he took it, engulfing hers, thinking how fine-boned she was, how frail. "I want to leave," she said calmly.
"I dinna blame you," he said,
with a glance at the house. The arbour was covered with new leaves, the green of them fresh and soft from the rain, but someone would find them soon.
"Shall we walk down by the loch for a bit?"
"No. I mean, I want to leave here. Lallybroch. For good." That took him aback more than a bit.
"You dinna mean that, I think," he said at last, cautious. "It's been a shock, after all. You shouldn't..."
She shook her head and put a hand to her breast.
"Something's broken in me, Jamie," she said softly. "Whatever it was that bound me, it binds me nae more."
He didn't know what to say. He'd avoided the sight of the broch and the burying ground at its foot when he came out of the house, unable to bear the dark, wet patch of raw ground there. But now he turned his head deliberately and raised his chin to point at it.
"And you'd leave Ian?" he asked.
She made a small noise in her throat. Her hand lay against her breast still, and at this she pressed it flat, fierce against her heart. "Ian's with me," she said, and her back straightened in defiance of the fresh-dug grave. "He'll never leave me, nor I him." She turned her head and looked at him then. Her eyes were red but dry.
"He'll never leave you either, Jamie," she said. "You ken that as well as I do."
Tears welled in his own eyes then, unexpected, and he turned his head away.
"I ken that, aye,"
he muttered, and hoped it was true. Just now the place inside him where he was accustomed to find Ian was empty, hollow and echoing as a boron.
Would he come back, Jamie wondered,
or had Ian only moved a bit to a different place of his heart, a place he hadn't yet looked?
He hoped.
But he wouldn't go looking just yet a while, and kent it was for fear of finding nothing. He wanted to change the subject, give her time and space to think, but it was difficult to find anything to say that didn't have to do with Ian being dead, or with death in general. All loss is one, and one loss becomes all. A single death, the key to the gate that bars memory.
"When Da died," he said suddenly, surprising himself as much as her, "tell me what happened."
He felt her turn to look at him, but kept his own eyes on his hands, the fingers of his left hand rubbing slowly over the thick red scar that ran down the back of his right. "They brought him home," she said at last, "lying in a wagon. It was Dougal Mackenzie with them. He told me Da had seen you being whipped, and all of a sudden he'd fallen down, and when they'd picked him up, one side of his face was drawn up in anguish, but the other was slack. He couldna speak or walk, and so they took him away and brought him home." She paused, swallowing, her eyes fixed on the broch and the burying ground. "I had a doctor to him. He bled Da more than once, and burned things in a wee burner and wafted the smoke under his nose. He tried to give him medicine, but Da couldna really swallow. I put drops of water on his tongue, but that was all." She sighed deeply. "He died the next day, about noon."
"Ah, he never spoke."
She shook her head. "He couldna speak at all. Only moved his mouth now and then and made wee gurgling sounds."
Her chin puckered a little at the memory, but she firmed her lips. I could see, though, near the end he was trying to speak. His mouth was trying to shape the words, and his eyes were on mine, trying to make me understand. She glanced at him. He did say Jamie the once. I ken that much for sure. For I thought he was trying to ask for you. And I told him Dougal said you were alive and promised that you'd be all right. That seemed to comfort him a bit, and he died soon after. He swallowed thickly, the sound of it loud in his ears. It had begun to rain again, lightly, drops pattering on the leaves overhead. Tanga, he said softly at last. I wondered. I wish I could have said sorry to him. You didn't need to, she said, just as softly. He'd have known it. He nodded, unable to speak for a moment. Getting himself under control, though, he took her hand again and turned to her. I can say sorry to you, though, Apure. And I do.
For what? She said, surprised.
For believing Dougal when he told me... Well, when he said you'd become an English soldier's whore. I was a fool.
He looked at his maimed hand, not wanting to meet her eyes. I will, she said, and laid her hand on his, light and cool as the new leaves that fluttered round them. You needed him. I didn't. They sat a while longer, feeling peaceful, holding hands. Where do you think he is now? Jenny said suddenly. Ian, I mean. He glanced at the house, then at the new grave waiting, but of course that wasn't Ian anymore. He was panicked for a moment, his earlier emptiness returning. But then it came to him, and without surprise, he knew what it was Ian had said to him.
On your right, man.
On his right, guarding his weak side.
He's just here,
he said to Jenny, nodding to the spot between them.
Where he belongs.
Part 7. Reap the Whirlwind. Chapter 85. Son of a Witch. When Roger and Buckley drove up to the house, Amanda rushed out to meet them and returned to her mother waving a blue plastic pinwheel on a stick.
Mama, look what I got. Look what I got.
Oh, how pretty.
Brianna bent to admire it, and blowing made the toy spin round.
I do it. I do it.
Amanda grabbed it back, puffing and blowing with great determination, but making little headway.
From the side, Alianan. From the side.
William Buckley came round the car and picked Amanda up, gently turning her hand so the pinwheel was perpendicular to her face.
Now blow.
He put his face close to hers and helped blow, and the pinwheel whirled like a June bug.
Aye, that's fine, isn't it? You have a go then, on your own.
He gave Bree a half-apologetic shrug and carried Amanda up the path, she industriously puffing and blowing. They passed Jem, who stopped to admire the pinwheel. Roger got out of the car with a couple of carrier bags and paused for a private word with Brianna.
If we had a dog, I wonder if it would like him too, she murmured, nodding after their guest, who was now engaged in animated conversation with both children. A man may smile and be a villain, Roger replied, watching with a narrowed eye. And the claims of instinct quite aside, I don't think either dogs or children are necessarily good judges of character.
Did he tell you anything else while you were out today? Roger had taken William Buckley into Inverness to replenish his wardrobe, as he possessed nothing more than the jeans, T-shirt, and charity store jacket in which he'd arrived.
A few things. I asked him how he'd come here, to Lallybroch, I mean, and what was he doing hanging about? He said he'd seen me on the street in Inverness and recognised me, but had got in my car and gone before he could make up his mind to talk to me. He saw me once or twice more, though,
and asked cautiously round to find out where I lived. He stopped and looked at her with a half-smile. Bear in mind what he is and when he came from. He thought, and I don't think he was telling me a tale, that I must be an old one.
Really?
Aye, really. And on the face of it, well, I did survive being hanged, which most people don't.
His mouth twisted a little as he touched the scar on his throat.
And we did obviously travel safely through the stones. I mean, I could see his point.
Despite her disquiet, she sniffed with amusement. Well, yes. You mean he was afraid of you? Roger shrugged, helpless.
He was. And I think I believe him, though I will say, if that's the case, he puts up a good front.
Would you act afraid if you were going to confront a powerful supernatural being? Or would you try to play it cool? Being a male of the species, as Mama puts it. Or a proper man, as Dar says. You and Dar both act like John Wayne if there's anything fishy going on, and this guy is related to both of you.
Good point, he said,
though his mouth twitched at the powerful supernatural being, or possibly the John Wayne part.
And he admitted that he was reeling a bit at the shock of everything. I could sympathize with that.
And we knew what we were doing, sort of. He told me what happened when he came through. Did he tell you that, too?
They had been walking slowly, but had nearly reached the door. She could hear Annie's voice in the hall asking something, exclaiming among the children's chatter, and the lower rumble of William Buckley's voice in reply.
Aye, he did. He wants, and wants badly, to get back to his own time. Clearly, I know how, and he'd have to come and talk to me to find out. But only a fool would walk straight up to a stranger's door, let alone a stranger you'd come close to killing, much less a stranger who might strike you dead on the spot, or turn you into a crow.
He shrugged again.
So he left his job and took to lurking about the place, watching, to see if we were tossing human boons out the back door, I suppose. Jem ran into him out by the broch one day, and he told him he was a Nucklevy, partly to scare him away, but also because if he came back and told me there was a Nucklevy up the hill, I might come out and do something magical about it. And if I did...
He lifted his hands, palms up.
If you did, you might be dangerous, but he'd also know you had the power to send him back. Like the Wizard of Oz.
He looked at her for a moment.
Anyone less like Judy Garland than him,
he began, but was interrupted by Annie MacDonald, demanding to know what they were hanging about being eaten by midges for when there was supper on the table. Apologising, they went inside. Brianna ate supper without really noticing what was on her plate. Jem was going to spend the night with Bobby again and go out fishing on Saturday with Rob on the Rothy Merkus estate. She felt a small twinge at that. She remembered her father patiently teaching Jem to cast with the homemade rod and thread line that was all they had. Would he remember? Still, it was just as well to have him out of the house. She and Roger were going to have to sit down with William Buckley and decide how best to get him back to his own time, and best if Jem wasn't lurking around the edges of such a discussion with his ears flapping. Should they consult Fiona? She wondered suddenly. Fiona Graham was the granddaughter of old Mrs. Graham, who had kept house for Roger's adoptive father, the Reverend Wakefield. The very proper and elderly Mrs. Graham had also been the caller, the holder of a very old tradition indeed. On the fire feast of Beltane, the women, whose families had passed the tradition down to them, met at dawn, and clothed in white, performed a dance that Roger said was an ancient Norse circle dance. And at the end of it, the caller sang out in words that none of them understood any more, bringing up the sun, so that as it rose above the horizon, the beam of light shot straight through the cleft of the split stone. Mrs. Graham had died peacefully in her sleep years before, but had left her knowledge and her role as caller to her granddaughter Fiona.
Fiona had helped Roger when he came through the stones to find Brianna, even contributing her own diamond engagement ring to help him, after his first attempt had ended, much as William Buckley described his own, in flames in the centre of the circle. They could get a gemstone without much trouble, she thought, automatically passing the bowl of salad to Roger. From what they knew so far, it didn't have to be a terribly expensive stone, or even a large one. The garnets in Roger's mother's locket had apparently been enough to keep him from being killed during his first abortive trip. She thought suddenly of the burn mark on William Buckley's chest, and as she did so, realized that she was staring at him, and he was staring back at her. She choked on a chunk of cucumber, and the subsequent hubbub of back-thumping and arm-raising and coughing and water-fetching luckily explained the redness of her face. Everyone settled back to their food, but she was aware of Roger looking sideways at her. She shot him a brief look under her lashes with a faint tilt of the head that said, "Later, upstairs." And he relaxed, resuming a three-way conversation with Uncle Buck and Jemmy about trout flies. She wanted to talk to him about what Buckley had said and decide what to do about him as soon as possible. She was not going to tell him what William Buckley had said about Rob Cameron. Roger lay in bed, watching the moonlight on Brianna's sleeping face. It was quite late, but he found himself wakeful. Odd, for he usually fell asleep in seconds after making love to her. Fortunately, she did too. She had tonight, curling into him like a large, affectionate shrimp before lapsing into naked, warm inertness in his arms. It had been wonderful, but that wee bit different. She was almost always willing, even eager, and that had been no different, though she'd made a particular point of deadbolting the bedroom door. He'd installed the deadbolt because Jem had learned to pick locks at the age of 7. It was still bolted, in fact, and seeing that, he slid carefully out from under the covers to unfasten it. Jem was spending the night with his new friend Bobby, but if Mandy needed them in the night, he didn't want the door locked. The room was cool, but pleasantly so. They'd put in baseboard heaters, which would be barely adequate to the winter temperature of the Highlands, but fine for late autumn. Bree slept hot. He'd swear her body temperature rose 2 or 3 degrees when she slept, and she often threw off the covers. She lay now, bare to the waist, arms flung over her head, and snoring faintly. He cupped a hand absently under his balls, wondering idly whether they might have another go. He thought she wouldn't mind, but... maybe he shouldn't. When he made love to her, he often took his time, and at the last was filled with a barbarous delight when she yielded her red-thatched quim, willingly, to be sure, but with an instant always of hesitation, just one final breath of something that wasn't quite resistance. He thought it was a means of assuring herself, if not him, that she had the right to refuse. A stronghold once breached and repaired has stouter defences. He didn't think she realised consciously that she did this. He'd never mentioned it to her, wanting no ghost to rise between them. It had been a little different tonight. She'd balked more noticeably, then yielded with something like ferocity, pulling him in and raking her nails down his back. And yet... he'd paused for that one instant, but once safely mounted, had had the insane urge to pillage ruthlessly, to show himself, if not her, that she was indeed his, and not her own, inviolate. And she'd egged him on. He noticed that he hadn't taken his hand away, and was now eyeing his wife like a Roman soldier sizing up one of the Sabine women for weight and portability. Raptio was the Latin word, usually translated as rape, though in fact it meant kidnapping or seizing. Raptio, raptor, the seizing of prey. He could see it both ways, and noticed at this point that he still hadn't actually removed his hand from his genitals, which in the meantime had decided unilaterally that no, she wouldn't mind at all. His cerebral cortex, rapidly being overpowered by something a lot older and much lower down, hazarded a last faint notion that it was to do with having a stranger in the house, especially one like William Buckley Mackenzie.
"Well, he'll be gone by salmon," Roger muttered, approaching the bed. "The portal in the stone should be wide open then, and with some sort of gem in hand, the bugger ought to be back to his wife in—"
He slid beneath the sheets, gathered his own wife up with a firm hand on her very warm bottom, and hissed in her ear,
"I'll get you and your little dog, too."
Her body quivered in a soundless subterranean laugh, and, eyes closed, she reached down and drew a delicate fingernail up his very sensitive flesh.
"I'm melting," she murmured.
He did fall asleep after that, but waked again somewhere in the wee hours and found himself annoyingly alert.
"That must be him," he thought, slithering out of bed again. "I'll not sleep sound until we get rid of him."
He didn't bother being careful. He could tell from the faint rasp of Brianna's snore that she was dead to the world. He pulled his pyjamas over his nakedness and stepped out into the upstairs corridor, listening. Lallybroch talked to itself at night, as all old houses do. He was used to the sudden startling cracks as wooden beams in the room cooled at night, and even the creaking of the second-floor hallway as though someone was walking rapidly up and down it. The rattle of windows when the wind was in the west, reminding him comfortably of Brianna's irregular snoring. It was remarkably quiet now, though, wrapped in the somnolence of deep night. They'd put William Buckley at the far end of the hall, having decided without speaking of it that they didn't want him above, on the same floor with the kids. Keep him close. Keep an eye on him. Roger walked quietly down the hall, listening. The crack under Buckley's door was dark, and from inside the room he heard a deep, regular snore, interrupted once as the sleeper turned in bed, muttered something incomprehensible, and dropped back into slumber.
"That's all right, then,"
Roger muttered to himself and turned away. His cerebral cortex, interrupted earlier, now patiently resumed its train of thought.
Of course it was to do with having a stranger in the house, and such a stranger.
Both he and Brianna felt obscurely threatened by his presence. In his own case, there was a solid substratum of anger under the wariness, and a good bit of confusion, too. He had, from sheer necessity as well as religious conviction, forgiven William Buckley for his role in the hanging that had taken his voice. After all, the man hadn't tried to kill him personally, and couldn't have known what would happen. But it was a damn sight easier to forgive someone you knew had been dead for 200 years than it was to maintain that forgiveness with a bastard living under your nose, eating your food, and being charming to your wife and children.
"And let us not forget he's a bastard too," Roger thought savagely, making his way down the stairs in the dark.
The family tree he'd shown William Buckley Mackenzie revealed him as all correct, pinned down on paper, neatly bracketed by parents and son. The chart was a lie, though. William Buckley Mackenzie was a changeling, the illegitimate offspring of Dougal Mackenzie, war chief of Clan Mackenzie, and Gilles Duncan, witch. And Roger thought William Buckley didn't know it. Safely at the bottom of the stair, he turned on the light in the lower hall and went to the kitchen to check that the back door was locked. They'd discussed that one, he and Brianna, but hadn't come to an agreement yet. He was for letting sleeping dogs lie. What good could it do the man to know the truth of his origins? The Highlands that had spawned those two wild souls was gone, both now and in William Buckley's rightful time. Bree had insisted that Buckley had some right to know the truth, though challenged, couldn't say quite what that right was.
"You are who you think you are, and you always have been," she said at last, frustrated but trying to explain. "I wasn't.
Do you think it would have been better if I'd never known who my real father was?
In all honesty, it might have been, he thought. The knowledge, once revealed, had torn both their lives apart, exposed them both to terrible things.
It had taken his voice, almost taken his life, had put her in danger, gotten her raped, been responsible for her having killed a man.
He hadn't spoken to her about that. He should.
He saw the weight of it in her eyes sometimes, and knew it for what it was. He carried the same weight. And yet, would he choose not to have known what he now knew? Never to have lived in the past, met Jamie Fraser, seen the side of Claire that existed only in Jamie's company? It wasn't the tree of good and evil in the Garden of Eden, after all. It was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Knowledge might be a poisoned gift, but it was still a gift, and few people would voluntarily give it back. Which was just as well, he supposed, since they couldn't give it back. And that had been his point in the discussion.
We don't know what harm it could do, he'd argued, but we don't know it couldn't do harm, and serious harm. And what would be the benefit to the man to know his mother was insane, a sorceress, or both? Certainly a multiple murderess. And his father an adulterer, and at the least an attempted murderer? It was enough of a shock to me when your mother told me about Gilles Duncan, and she's 8 generations removed from me. Before you ask, yes, I could have lived without knowing that.
She'd bitten her lip at that, and nodded, reluctant. It's just... I keep thinking about Willie, Bree had said at last, giving up. Not William Buckley, I don't mean. My brother. She flushed a little, as she always did, self-conscious at speaking the word. I really wanted him to know. But Da and Lord John, they so didn't want him to know, and maybe they were right. He has a life, a good one. And they said he couldn't keep on having that life if I told him.
They were right, Roger had said bluntly. To tell him, if he believed it, would force him to live in a state of deceit and denial which would eat him alive. Or to openly acknowledge that he's the bastard son of a Scottish criminal. Which is just not on. Not in the 18th century culture.
They wouldn't have taken his title away, Bree had argued. Da said that by British law, a child born in wedlock is the legal offspring of the husband, no matter whether the husband was the real father or not.
No. But imagine living with a title you don't think you're entitled to. Knowing the blood in your veins isn't the blue you've always thought it was. Having people call you Lord So-and-so, and knowing what they'd call you if they knew the truth.
He'd shaken her gently, trying to make her see.
Either way, it would destroy the life he has, as surely as if you'd set him on a keg of gunpowder and lit the fuse. You wouldn't know when the bang would come, but come it would.
Mm-hmm, she'd said, and the argument ended there. But it hadn't been a sound of agreement, and he knew the argument wasn't over. By now he had checked all the doors and windows on the ground floor, ending in his study. He flipped on the light and came into the room. He was wide awake, nerves on edge. Why? He wondered. Was the house trying to tell him something? He snorted a little. Hard not to have fancies in the middle of the night in an old house with the wind rattling the window panes. And yet he usually felt very comfortable in this room, felt it was his place. What was wrong? He glanced quickly over the desk, the deep windowsill with a small pot of yellow chrysanthemums that Bree had put there, the shelves. He stopped dead, heart thumping in his chest. The snake wasn't there. No, it was. His roving eye fixed on it. It was in the wrong place, though. It wasn't in front of the wooden box that held Claire and Jamie's letters, but sitting in front of the books, 2 shelves below it. He picked it up, automatically stroking the old polished cherry wood with his thumb. Perhaps Annie MacDonald had moved it. No, she did dust and sweep in the study, but she never moved anything from its place. Never moved anything anywhere, for that matter. He'd seen her pick up a pair of galoshes carelessly left in the middle of the mudroom, sweep carefully under them, and set them back in the same place, mud splashes and all. She would never have moved the snake. Still less would Brianna have moved it. He knew, without knowing how he knew it, that she felt as he did about it. Willie Fraser's snake guarded his brother's treasure. He was lifting down the box before his train of conscious thought had reached its logical conclusion. Alarm bells were going off right and left. The contents of the box had been disturbed. The little books were on top of the letters at one end of the box, not underneath. He took out the letters, cursing himself for never having counted them. How would he know if one was missing? He sorted them quickly, read and unread, and thought the unread pile was about the same. Whoever had been in the box hadn't opened them, that was something. But whoever it was had probably wanted to avoid detection, too. He thumbed hastily through the opened letters and became aware at once that one was missing. The one written on Brianna's handmade paper with the embedded flowers. The first one. Jesus, what had it said? We are alive. He remembered that much. And then Claire had told all about the explosion and the burning of the big house. Had she said in that one they were going to Scotland? Maybe so. But why in bloody hell should... Two floors above, Mandy sat up in bed and screamed like a banshee. He made it to Amanda's room, a half-step before Brianna, and scooped the child out of her bed, cradling her against his pounding heart.
Jimmy! Jimmy! She sobbed. He's gone! He's gone! He's gone!
This last was shrieked as she stiffened in Roger's arms, digging her feet hard into his belly.
Hey, hey, he soothed, trying to rearrange her and pet her into calm. It's okay. Jimmy's fine. He's fine. He's only gone to visit Bobby overnight. He'll be home tomorrow.
He's gone!
She squirmed like an eel, not trying to get away, but merely possessed in a paroxysm of frantic grief.
He's not here. He's not here.
Aye, like I said, he's at Bobby's house. He...
Not here,
she said urgently, and thumped the palm of her hand repeatedly on the top of her head.
Not here with me.
Here, baby, come here, Bree said urgently, taking the tear-streaked child from him.
Mama, Mama, Jemmy's gone.
She clung to Bree, staring desperately, still thumping her head.
He's not with me.
Bree frowned at Mandy, puzzled, a hand running over her, checking for temperature, swollen glands, tender tummy. Not with you, she repeated, speaking intently, trying to get Mandy out of her panic. Tell Mummy what you mean, sweetheart.
Not here.
In utter desperation, Mandy lowered her head and butted her mother in the chest. Oof! The door at the end of the hall opened, and William Buckley came out, wearing Roger's woolen dressing gown. What in the name of the blessed virgin's all this riot? He inquired.
He took it. He took him,
Mandy shrieked, and buried her head in Brianna's shoulder. Despite himself, Roger was feeling infected by Amanda's fear, irrationally convinced that something terrible had happened.
Do you know where Jem is? He snapped at Buckley. I do not,
Buckley frowned at him.
Is he not in his bed?
No, he isn't, Brianna snapped.
You saw him leave, for heaven's sake.
She forced her way between the men. Quit it right now, both of you. Roger, take Mandy. I'm going to phone Martina Hurra. She thrust Amanda, moaning around the thumb in her mouth, into his arms, and hurried for the stairs, her hastily acquired nightclothes rustling like leaves. He rocked Amanda, distracted, alarmed, nearly overcome by her sense of panic. She emitted fright and grief like a radio broadcasting tower, and his own breath came short, and his hands were wet with sweat where he clutched her Winnie the Pooh nightie.
Hush, Akushla, he said, pitching his voice as calmly as he could. Hush now. We'll fix it. You tell Daddy what waked you up, and I'll fix it. Promise.
She obediently tried to stifle her sobs,
rubbing chubby fists into her eyes.
Jimmy, she moaned. I want Jimmy.
We'll get him back straight away, Roger promised. Tell me, what made you wake up? Did you have a bad dream?
Uh-huh.
She clutched him tighter, her face full of fear.
Was big walks? Big walks? They screamed at me.
Ice water ran straight through his veins.
Jesus, oh Jesus.
Maybe she did remember her trip through the stones.
Aye, I see,
he said, patting her as soothingly as he could for the ferment in his own breast. He did see. In memory, he saw those stones, felt and heard them again, and, turning a little, saw the pallor of William Buckley's face and knew he heard the ring of truth in Mandy's voice too.
What happened then, Aliannon? Did you go close to the big rocks?
Not me. Jem, that man took him, and the walks ate him.
At this she collapsed in tears again, sobbing inconsolably.
That man,
Roger said slowly, and turned a little more so that William Buckley was in her field of view.
Do you mean this man, sweetheart? Uncle Buck?
No, 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 a other man.
She straightened up, staring into his face with huge, tear-filled eyes, straining to make him understand.
Bobby's daddy.
He heard Brianna coming upstairs, fast but unevenly. It sounded as though she was bumping against the walls of the staircase, losing her balance as she hurried. She stumbled into view at the top of the stair, and Roger felt every hair on his body stand up at the sight of her white, staring face.
He's gone,
she said, hoarse. Martina says he's not with Bobby. She didn't expect him tonight at all. I made her go outside and look. Rob lives three houses down. She says his truck is gone. Roger's hands were numb with cold and the steering wheel was slippery with their sweat. He took the turn off the highway at such speed that the off wheels lifted slightly and the car tilted. William Buckley's head thumped the window.
Sorry,
Roger muttered mechanically, and received a grunt of acceptance in reply.
Mind yourself, Buckley said, rubbing his temple. You'll have us over in a ditch, and then what?
Then what indeed? With great effort, he eased his foot back on the gas. It was near moonset, and a wan quarter moon did little to light the landscape, black as pitch around them. The headlights of the little Morris barely dented the darkness, and the frail beam swung to and fro as they bounced crazily on the dirt road that led near Craignadoon.
Why the devil should this Trustair take your son?
Buckley rolled down his window and stuck his head out, vainly trying to see farther than the view through the dust-coated windshield.
And why, for the sake of All Holy, bring him here? How do I know?
Roger said through his teeth.
Maybe he thinks he needs blood to open the stones. Christ, why did I write that?
He pounded a fist on the wheel in frustration. Buckley blinked, very startled, but his gaze sharpened at once.
Is that it? He said, urgent. Is that how you do it? Blood? No, damn it,
Roger said.
It's the time of year and gemstones, we think. But you wrote down blood, with a query mark next it. Yes, but what do you mean? Did you read my notebook too, you cunt? Language, son, said William Buckley, grim but cool. Of course I did. I read everything in your study I could get my hands on, and so would you in my place.
Roger throttled back the panic that gripped him, enough to manage a curt nod.
Aye, maybe I would. And if you'd taken Jem, I'd kill you once I found you. But I'd maybe understand why. But this fucker, what does he think he's doing, for God's sake? Calm yourself, Buckley advised him briefly. You'll do your way no good if you lose the heed. This Cameron, is he one like us? I don't know. I don't bloody know. There are others, though. It's not just in the family. I don't know. I think there are others, but I don't know for sure.
Roger struggled to think, struggled to keep the car rolling at a low enough speed to handle the curves of the road half overgrown with creeping gorse. He was trying to pray, but managing nothing but a terror-stricken, incoherent, "Lord, please." He wished Bree was with him, but they couldn't have brought Mandy anywhere near the rocks. And if they should be in time to catch Cameron, if Cameron was even here, Buckley would help him. He was fairly sure of that. The back of his mind harboured a forlorn hope that there was some misunderstanding, that Cameron had mistaken the night, and realising it, was bringing Jem back home even as Roger and his bloody five-times-great-grandfather tore over a rocky moor in the dark, headed straight for the most terrible thing either of them knew.
Cameron. He read the notebook too,
Roger blurted, unable to bear his own thoughts.
By accident. He pretended to think it was all a fiction, something I made up for fun. Jesus, what have I done? Look out!
Buckley threw his arms over his face, and Roger stood on the brake, swerving off the road and into a large rock, barely missing the old blue truck that stood on the road, dark and empty. He scrambled up the hill, scrabbling for handholds in the dark, rocks rolling under his feet, gorse prickles piercing his palms, now and then stabbing under his nails, making him swear. Far below, he could hear William Buckley following, slowly, but following. He began to hear them long before he reached the crest. It was 3 days before Salmon, and the stones knew it. The sound that wasn't a sound at all vibrated through the marrow of his bones, made his skull ring and his teeth ache. He gritted his teeth together and kept on. By the time he reached the stones, he was on hands and knees, unable to stand upright.
Dear God, he thought, God preserve me. Keep me alive long enough to find him.
He could barely form thoughts, but recalled the flashlight. He'd brought it from the car, and now fumbled it out of his pocket, dropping it, having to grope frantically over the short grass in the circle, finding it at last, and squeezing the button with a finger that slipped off 4 times before finally achieving the strength to make the connection. The beam of light sprang out, and he heard a muffled exclamation of amazement from the dark behind him. Of course, he thought dazedly. William Buckley hadn't yet seen a flashlight. The wavering beam passed slowly round the circle, back. What was he looking for? Footprints? Something Jem had dropped that would show he'd come this way? There was nothing. Nothing but the stones. It was getting worse, and he dropped the flashlight, clutching his head with both hands. He had to move, had to go. Go get Jem. He was dragging himself over the grass, white blind with the pain and nearly mindless, when strong hands grabbed him by the ankles and hauled him backward. He thought there might have been a voice, but if so, it was lost in the piercing scream that echoed inside his head, inside his soul, and he cried out his son's name as loud as he could, to hear something besides that noise, felt his throat tear from the effort, but heard nothing. Then the earth moved beneath him, and the world fell away. Fell away, quite literally. When he came to some time later, he found that he and William Buckley were resting in a shallow declivity in the side of the hill, 40 feet below the stone circle. They'd fallen and rolled. He could tell that from the way he felt and the way Buckley looked. There was a hint of dawn in the sky, and he could see Buckley, scratched and torn, sitting hunched beside him, curled into himself as though his belly hurt.
What? Roger whispered.
He cleared his throat and tried again to ask what had happened, but couldn't manage more than a whisper, and even that made his throat burn like fire. William Buckley muttered something under his breath, and Roger realized that he was praying. He tried to sit up and made it, though his head spun.
Did you drag me free?
He demanded in his harsh whisper. Buckley's eyes were closed and stayed that way until he had finished his prayer. Then he opened them and glanced from Roger to the top of the hill, where the unseen stones still choired their ghastly song of time undone. No more from here, thank goodness, than an eerie whine that set his teeth on edge.
I did, Buckley said. I didn't think you were going to make it out on your own. I wasn't.
Roger lowered himself back onto the ground, dizzy and aching. Thanks, he added a moment later. There was a great void inside him, vast as the fading sky.
Oh, well, maybe it'll help to make up for getting you hanged, Buckley said in an offhand way.
What now?
Roger stared up at the sky, rotating slowly overhead. It made him dizzier, so he closed his eyes and reached out a hand.
Now we go home, he croaked, and think again. Help me up.
Chapter 86 Valley Forge. William wore his uniform. It was necessary, he told his father.
Denzel Hunter is a man of great conscience and principle. I cannot engage to winkle him out of the American camp without proper leave of his officer. I think he would not come. But if I can obtain permission, and I think I can, then I believe he will.
But to obtain formal permission for the services of a continental surgeon, obviously, he had to ask formally, which meant riding into Washington's new winter quarters at Valley Forge in a red coat, no matter what happened next. Lord John had closed his eyes for a moment, plainly envisioning just what sort of thing might happen next, but then opened them and said briskly,
All right, then. Will you take a servant with you?
No, William said, surprised.
Why would I need one? To care for the horses, to manage your goods, and to be the eyes in the back of your head, his father said, giving him a look indicating that he should already have been aware of some of this. He therefore did not say, horses, or what goods, but merely nodded and said, Thank you, Papa. Can you find me someone suitable?
Suitable turned out to be one Colenso Baragwanath, a stunted youth from Cornwall who had come with Howe's troops as a stable boy. He did know horses. William would give him that. There were four horses and a pack mule, this last laden with sides of pork, four or five fat turkeys, a bag of rough-skinned potatoes, another of turnips, and a large keg of cider.
If conditions there are half as bad as I think they are, his father had told him while overseeing the loading of the mule, the commander would lend you the services of half a battalion in exchange for this, let alone a surgeon.
Thank you, Papa, he said again, and swung into his saddle, his new captain's gorget about his neck, and a white flag of truce folded neatly into his saddlebag.
Valley Forge looked like a gigantic encampment of doomed charcoal burners. The place was essentially a woodlot, or had been before Washington's soldiers began felling everything in sight. Hacked stumps were everywhere, and the ground was strewn with broken branches. Huge bonfires burned in random spots, and piles of logs were stacked everywhere. They were building huts as fast as possible, and none too soon, for snow had already begun falling 3 or 4 hours before, and the camp was already blanketed with white. William hoped they'd be able to see the flag of truce.
Right, up you go, and ride ahead of me, he told Colenso, handing the boy the long stick to which he'd tied the flag.
The youth's eyes widened in horror.